As babies in crib, Dwayne remembered now, they used to suck each other's thumbs. Here's how Dwayne happened to have stepbrothers, incidentally, even though he had been adopted by people who couldn't have children of their own. Their adopting him triggered something to their bodies which made it possible for them to have children after all. This was a common phenomenon. A lot of couples seemed to be programmed that way. Dwayne was so glad to see them now, these two little men in overalls and work shoes, each wearing a pork pie hat. They were familiar. They were real. Dwayne closed his door on the chaos outside.
All right, he said. What's happened at the cave?
Ever since Lyle had his nose broken, the twins agreed that Lyle should do the talking for the two. Kyle hadn't said 1,000 words since 1954.
Them bubbles is halfway up to the cathedral now, said Lyle. The way they're coming, they'll be up to Moby Dick in a week or two.
Dwayne understood him perfectly. The underground stream, which passed through the bowels of Sacred Miracle Cave, was polluted by some sort of industrial waste, which formed bubbles as tough as ping-pong balls. These bubbles were shouldering one another up a passage, which led to a big boulder, which had been painted white to resemble Moby Dick, the great white whale. The bubbles would soon engulf Moby Dick and invade the Cathedral of Whispers, which was the main attraction of the cave. Thousands of people had been married in the Cathedral of Whispers, including Dwayne and Lyle and Kyle. Harry LeSabre, too. Lyle told Dwayne about an experiment he and Kyle had performed the night before. They had gone into the cave with their identical Browning automatic shotguns, and they had opened fire on the advancing wall of bubbles.
"They let loose a stink you wouldn't believe," said Lyle. He said it smelled like athlete's foot. "It drove me and Kyle right out of there. We run the ventilating system for an hour, and then we went back in. The paint was blistered on Moby Dick. He ain't even got eyes anymore."
Moby Dick used to have long-lashed blue eyes as big as dinner plates.
"The organ turned black and the ceiling turned a kind of dirty yellow," said Lyle. "You can't hardly see the sacred miracle no more."
The organ was the pipe organ of the gods, a thicket of stalactites and stalagmites, which had grown together in one corner of the cathedral. There was a loudspeaker in the back of it, through which music for weddings and funerals was played. It was illuminated by electric lights, which changed colors all the time. The sacred miracle was a cross on the ceiling of the cathedral. It was formed by the intersection of two cracks.
"It never was real easy to see," said Lyle, speaking of the cross. "I ain't even sure it's there anymore."
He asked Wayne's permission to order a load of cement. He wanted to plug up the passage between the stream and the cathedral.
"Just forget about Moby Dick and Jesse James and the slaves and all that," said Lyle, "and save the cathedral."
Jesse James was a skeleton which Dwayne's stepfather had bought from the estate of a doctor back during the Great Depression. The bones of its right hand mingled with the rusted parts of a .45 caliber revolver. Tourists were told that it had been found that way, that it probably belonged to some railroad robber who had been trapped in the cave by a rock slide. As for the slaves, these were plaster statues of black men in a chamber 50 feet down the corridor from Jesse James. The statues were removing one another's chains with hammers and hacksaws. Tourists were told that real slaves had at one time used the cave after escaping to freedom across the Ohio River. The story about the slaves was as fake as the one about Jesse James. The cave wasn't discovered until 1937, when a small earthquake opened it up a crack. Dwayne Hoover himself discovered the crack, and then he and his stepfather opened it with crowbars and dynamite. Before that, not even small animals had been in there. The only connection the cave had with slavery was this. The farm on which it was discovered was started by an ex-slave, Josephus Hubler. He was freed by his master, and he came north and started the farm. Then he went back and bought his mother and a woman who became his wife. Their descendants continued to run the farm until the Great Depression, when the Midland County Merchants Bank foreclosed on the mortgage. And then Dwayne's stepfather was hit by an automobile driven by a white man who had bought the farm. In an out-of-court settlement for his injuries, Dwayne's stepfather was given what he called contemptuously a goddamn nigger farm. Dwayne remembered the first trip the family took to see it. His father ripped a nigger sign off the nigger mailbox, and he threw it into a ditch. Here's what it said. Bluebird Farm. 14. The truck carrying Kilgore trout was in West Virginia now. The surface of the state had been demolished by men and machinery and explosives in order to make it yield up its coal. The coal was mostly gone now. It had been turned to heat. The surface of West Virginia, with its coal and trees and topsoil gone, was rearranging what was left of itself in conformity with the laws of gravity. It was collapsing into all the holes which had been dug into it. Its mountains, which had once found it easy to stand by themselves, were sliding into valleys now. The demolition of West Virginia had taken place with the approval of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the state government, which drew their power from the people. Here and there, an inhabited dwelling still stood. Trout saw a broken guardrail ahead. He gazed into a gully below it, saw a 1968 Cadillac Eldorado capsized in a brook. It had Alabama license plates. There were also several old home appliances in the brook, stoves, a washing machine, a couple of refrigerators. An angel-faced white child with flaxen hair stood by the brook. She waved up at Trout. She clasped an 18-ounce bottle of Pepsi-Cola to her breast. Trout asked himself out loud what the people did for amusement, and the driver told him a queer story about a night he spent in West Virginia in the cab of his truck near a windowless building which droned monotonously. "I'd see the folks go in and I'd see the folks come out," he said, "but I couldn't figure out what kind of machine it was that made the drone. The building was a cheap old frame thing set up on cement blocks, and it was out in the middle of nowhere. Cars came and went, and the folks sure seemed to like whatever was doing the droning," he said. So he had a look inside. "It was full of folks on roller skates," he said. "They went around and around. Nobody smiled. They just went around and around." He told Trout about people he'd heard of in the area who grabbed live copperheads and rattlesnakes during church services to show how much they believed that Jesus would protect them. "Takes all kinds of people to make up a world," said Trout. Trout marveled at how recently white men had arrived in West Virginia and how quickly they had demolished it for heat. Now all the heat was gone, too, into outer space, Trout supposed. It had boiled water and the steam had made steel windmills whiz around and around. The windmills had made rotors and generators whiz around and around. America was jazzed with electricity for a while. Coal had also powered old-fashioned steamboats and choo-choo trains. Choo-choo trains and steamboats and factories had whistles which were blown by steam when Dwayne Hoover and Kilgore Trout and I were boys, when our fathers were boys, when our grandfathers were boys. Steam from water boiled by burning coal was sent raging through the whistles, which made harshly beautiful laments, as though they were the voice boxes of mating or dying dinosaurs. Cries such as, "Woo-a, woo-a," and "Torn," and so on. A dinosaur was a reptile as big as a choo-choo train. It had two brains, one for its front end and one for its rear end. It was extinct. Both brains combined were smaller than a pea. A pea was a legume. Coal was a highly compressed mixture of rotten trees and flowers and bushes and grasses and so on, and dinosaur excrement. Kilgore Trout thought about the cries of steam whistles he had known and about the destruction of West Virginia, which made their songs possible. He supposed that the heart-rending cries had fled into outer space along with the heat. He was mistaken. Like most science fiction writers, Trout knew almost nothing about science, was bored stiff by technical details. But no cry from a whistle had gotten very far from Earth for this reason. Sound could only travel in an atmosphere. And the atmosphere of Earth, relative to the planet, wasn't even as thick as the skin of an apple. Beyond that lay an all but perfect vacuum. An apple was a popular fruit. The driver was a big eater. He pulled into a McDonald's hamburger establishment. There were many different chains of hamburger establishments in the country. McDonald's was one. Burger Chef was another. Dwayne Hoover, as has already been said, owned franchises for several burger chefs. A hamburger was made out of an animal, which was killed and ground up into little bits, then shaped into patties and fried, and put between two pieces of bread. And Trout, who had so little money left, ordered a cup of coffee. He asked an old man on a stool next to him at the table if he had worked in the coal mines. The old man said this, "From the time I was 10 till I was 62. "You glad to be out of them?" said Trout. "Oh, God," said the man. "You never get out of them, even when you sleep. I dream mines." Trout asked him what it had felt like to work for an industry whose business was to destroy the countryside, and the old man said he was usually too tired to care. "Don't matter if you care," the old miner said, "if you don't own what you care about."
He pointed out that the mineral rights to the entire county in which they sat were owned by the Rosewater Coal and Iron Company, which had acquired these rights soon after the end of the Civil War. "The law says," he went on, "when a man owns something under the ground and he wants to get at it, you got to let him tear up anything between the surface and what he owns."
Trout did not make the connection between Rosewater Coal and Iron Company and Elliot Rosewater, his only fan. He still thought Elliot Rosewater was a teenager.
The truth was that Rosewater's ancestors had been among the principal destroyers of the surface and the people of West Virginia.
"It don't seem right, though," the old miner said to Trout, "that a man can own what's underneath another man's farm or woods or house. And any time the man wants to get what's underneath all that, he's got a right to wreck what's on top to get at it. The rights of the people on top of the ground don't amount to nothing compared to the rights of the man who owns what's underneath."
He remembered out loud when he and other miners used to try to force the Rosewater Coal and Iron Company to treat them like human beings. They would fight small wars with the company's private police and the state police and the National Guard.
"I never saw Rosewater," he said, "but Rosewater always won. I walked on Rosewater. I dug holes for Rosewater in Rosewater. I lived in Rosewater houses. I ate Rosewater food. I'd fight Rosewater, whatever Rosewater is, and Rosewater would beat me and leave me for dead. You ask people around here and they'll tell you, this whole world is Rosewater, as far as they're concerned."
The driver knew Trout was bound for Midland City. He didn't know Trout was a writer on his way to an arts festival. Trout understood that honest working people had no use for the arts.
"Why would anybody in his right mind go to Midland City?" the driver wanted to know. They were riding along again.
"My sister is sick," said Trout. "Midland City is the asshole of the universe," said the driver.
"I've often wondered where the asshole was," said Trout.
"If it isn't in Midland City," said the driver, "it's in Libertyville, Georgia. Did you ever see Libertyville?"
"No," said Trout.
"I was arrested for speeding down there. They had a speed trap where all of a sudden you had to go from 50 down to 15 miles an hour. It made me mad. I had some words with the policeman, and he put me in jail. The main industry there was pulping up old newspapers and magazines and books and making new paper out of them," said the driver. "Trucks and trains were bringing in hundreds of tons of unwanted printed material every day."
Said Trout.
"And the unloading process was sloppy, so there were pieces of books and magazines and so blowing all over town. If you wanted to start a library, you could just go over to the freight yard and carry away all the books you wanted."
Said Trout.
Up ahead was a white man hitchhiking with his pregnant wife and 9 children.
"Looks like Gary Cooper, don't he?"
said the truck driver of the hitchhiking man.
"Yes, he does," said Trout.
Gary Cooper was a movie star.
"Anyway," said the driver, "they had so many books in Libertyville, they used books for toilet paper in the jail. They got me in a Friday late in the afternoon, so I couldn't have a hearing in court until Monday. So I sat there in the calaboose for 2 days with nothing to do but read my toilet paper. I can still remember one of the stories I read."
Said Trout.
"That was the last story I ever read," said the driver. "My God, that must have been all of 15 years ago. The story was about another planet. It was a crazy story. They had museums full of paintings all over the place, and the government used a kind of roulette wheel to decide what to put in the museums and what to throw out."
Kilgore Trout was suddenly woozy with deja vu. The truck driver was reminding him of the premise of a book he hadn't thought about for years. The driver's toilet paper in Libertyville, Georgia, had been The Barring Gaffner of Bagni Alto, or This Year's Masterpiece, by Kilgore Trout. The name of the planet where Trout's book took place was Bagni Alto. And a Barring Gaffner there was a government official who spun a wheel of chance once a year. Citizens submitted works of art to the government, and these were given numbers, and then they were assigned cash values according to the Barring Gaffner spins of the wheel. The viewpoint of character of the tale was not the Barring Gaffner, but a humble cobbler named Goose. Goose lived alone, and he painted a picture of his cat. It was the only picture he had ever painted. He took it to the Barring Gaffner, who numbered it and put it in a warehouse crammed with works of art. The painting by Goose had an unprecedented gush of luck on the wheel. It became worth 18,000 lambos, the equivalent of $1 billion on Earth. The Barring Gaffner awarded Goose a check for that amount, most of which was taken back at once by the tax collector.
The picture was given a place of honor in the National Gallery, and people lined up for miles for a chance to see a painting worth $1 billion. There was also a huge bonfire of all the paintings and statues and books and so on, which the wheel had said were worthless. And then it was discovered that the wheel was rigged, and the Baring Gaffner committed suicide. It was an amazing coincidence that the truck driver had read a book by Kilgore Trout. Trout had never met a reader before, and his response now was interesting. He did not admit that he was the father of the book. The driver pointed out that all the mailboxes in the area had the same last name painted on them. "There's another one," he said, indicating a mailbox which said, J.A. Hubler. The truck was passing through the area where Duane Hoover's step-parents had come from. They had trekked from West Virginia to Midland City during the First World War to make big money at the Kiesler Automobile Company, which was manufacturing airplanes and trucks. When they got to Midland City, they had changed their name legally from Hubler to Hoover, because there were so many black people in Midland City named Hubler. As Duane Hoover's stepfather explained to him one time, "It was embarrassing. Everybody up here naturally assumed Hubler was a nigger name." 15. Duane Hoover got through lunch all right that day. He remembered now about Hawaiian Week. The ukuleles and so on were no longer mysterious. The pavement between his automobile agency and the new Holiday Inn was no longer a trampoline. He drove to lunch alone in an air-conditioned demonstrator, a blue Pontiac Le Mans with a cream interior, with his radio on. He heard several of his own radio commercials, which drove home the point, "You can always trust Duane." Though his mental health had improved remarkably since breakfast, a new symptom of illness made itself known. It was incipient echolalia. Duane found himself wanting to repeat out loud whatever had just been said. So when the radio told him, "You can always trust Duane," he echoed the last word. "Duane," he said. When the radio said there had been a tornado in Texas, Duane said this out loud. "Texas." Then he heard that husbands of women who had been raped during the war between India and Pakistan wouldn't have anything to do with their wives anymore. The women, in the eyes of their husbands, had become unclean, said the radio. "Unclean," said Duane. As for Wayne Hubler, the black ex-convict whose only dream was to work for Duane Hoover, he had learned to play hide-and-seek with Duane's employees. He did not wish to be ordered off the property for hanging around used cars. So, when an employee came near, Wayne would wander off to the garbage and trash area behind the Holiday Inn and gravely study the remains of club sandwiches and empty packs of Salem cigarettes and so on in the cans back there, as though he were a health inspector or some such thing. When the employee went away, Wayne would drift back to the used cars, keeping the boiled eggs of his eyes peeled for the real Duane Hoover. The real Duane Hoover, of course, had, in effect, denied that he was Duane. So, when the real Duane came out at lunchtime, Wayne, who had nobody to talk to but himself, said this to himself. "That ain't Mr. Hoover. Sure looked like Mr. Hoover, though. Maybe Mr. Hoover's sick today." And so on. Duane had a hamburger and french fries and a Coke at his newest burger chef, which was out on Crestview Avenue, across the street from where the new John F. Kennedy High School was going up. John F. Kennedy had never been to Midland City, but he was a president of the United States who was shot to death. Presidents of the country were often shot to death. The assassins were confused by some of the same bad chemicals which troubled Duane. Duane certainly wasn't alone as far as having bad chemicals inside of him was concerned. He had plenty of company throughout all history. In his own lifetime, for instance, the people in a country called Germany were so full of bad chemicals for a while that they actually built factories whose only purpose was to kill people by the millions. The people were delivered by railroad trains. After the Germans got well again, they manufactured a cheap and durable automobile which became popular all over the world, especially among young people. People called it the Beetle. The mechanical Beetle was made by Germans. The real Beetle was made by the creator of the universe. Duane's waitress at the Burger Chef was a 17-year-old white girl named Patty Keene. Her hair was yellow, her eyes were blue. She was very old for a mammal. Most mammals were senile or dead by the time they were 17. But Patty was a sort of mammal which developed very slowly, so the body she rode around in was only now mature. She was a brand new adult who was working in order to pay off the tremendous doctors and hospital bills her father had run up in the process of dying of cancer of the colon and then cancer of the everything.
This was in a country where everybody was expected to pay his own bills for everything, and one of the most expensive things a person could do was get sick. Patty Keene's father's sickness cost 10 times as much as all the trips to Hawaii, which Duane was going to give away at the end of Hawaiian Week. Duane appreciated Patty Keene's brand newness, even though he was not sexually attracted to women that young. She was like a new automobile, which hadn't even had its radio turned on yet. And Duane was reminded of a ditty his father would sing sometimes when his father was drunk. It went like this. Roses are red and ready for plucking. You're 16 and ready for high school. Patty Keene was stupid on purpose, which was the case with most women in Midland City. The women all had big minds because they were big animals, but they did not use them much for this reason. Unusual ideas could make enemies. And the women, if they were going to achieve any sort of comfort and safety, needed all the friends they could get. So, in the interests of survival, they trained themselves to be agreeing machines instead of thinking machines. All their minds had to do was to discover what other people were thinking, and then they thought that, too. Patty knew who Duane was. Duane didn't know who Patty was. Patty's heart beat faster when she waited on him, because Duane could solve so many of her problems with the money and power he had. He could give her a fine house and new automobiles and nice clothes and a life of leisure, and he could pay all the medical bills as easily as she had given him his hamburger and his French fries and his Coke. Duane could do for her what the fairy godmother did for Cinderella, if he wanted to. And Patty had never been so close to such a magical person before. She was in the presence of the supernatural. And she knew enough about Midland City and herself to understand that she might never be this close to the supernatural ever again. Patty Keene actually imagined Duane's waving a magic wand at her troubles and dreams. She spoke up bravely to learn if supernatural assistance was possible in her case. She was willing to do without it, expected to do without it, to work hard all her life, to get not much in return, and to associate with other men and women who were poor and powerless and in debt. She said this to Duane. "Excuse me for calling you by name, Mr. Hoover, but I can't help knowing who you are, with your picture and all your ads and everything. Besides, everybody else who works here told me who you were. When you came in, they just buzzed and buzzed." "Buzzed," said Duane. This was his echolalia again. "I guess that isn't the right word," she said. She was used to apologizing for her use of language. She had been encouraged to do that a lot in school. Most white people in Midland City were insecure when they spoke, so they kept their sentences short and their words simple in order to keep embarrassing mistakes to a minimum. Duane certainly did that. Patty certainly did that. This was because their English teachers would wince and cover their ears and give them flunking grades and so on whenever they failed to speak like English aristocrats before the First World War. Also, they were told that they were unworthy to speak or write their language if they couldn't love or understand incomprehensible novels and poems and plays about people long ago and far away, such as Ivanhoe. The black people would not put up with this. They went on talking English every which way. They refused to read books they couldn't understand on the grounds they couldn't understand them. They would ask such impudent questions, such as, "What for want to read no Tale of Two Cities? What for?" Patty Keene flunked English during the semester when she had to read and appreciate Ivanhoe, which was about men in iron suits and the women who loved them. And she was put in a remedial reading class where they made her read The Good Earth, which was about Chinamen. It was during this same semester that she lost her virginity. She was raped by a white gas conversion unit installer named Don Breedlove in the parking lot outside the Bannister Memorial Fieldhouse at the county fairgrounds after the regional high school basketball playoffs. She never reported it to the police. She never reported it to anybody, since her father was dying at the time. There was enough trouble already. The Bannister Memorial Fieldhouse was named in honor of George Hickman Bannister, a 17-year-old boy who was killed while playing high school football in 1924. George Hickman Bannister had the largest tombstone in Cavalry Cemetery, a 62-foot obelisk with a marble football on top. Football was a war game. Two opposing teams fought over the ball while wearing armor made out of leather and cloth and plastic. George Hickman Bannister was killed while trying to get a hold of the ball on Thanksgiving Day. Thanksgiving Day was a holiday when everybody in the country was expected to express gratitude to the creator of the universe, mainly for food. George Hickman Bannister's obelisk was paid for by public subscription,
with the Chamber of Commerce matching every $2 raised with a dollar of its own. It was for many years the tallest structure in Midland City. A city ordinance was passed which made it illegal to erect anything taller than that, and it was called the George Hickman Bannister Law. The ordinance was junked later on to allow radio towers to go up. The two largest monuments in town, until the new Mildred Barry Memorial Arts Center went up in Sugar Creek, were constructed supposedly so that George Hickman Bannister would never be forgotten. But nobody ever thought about him anymore by the time Dwayne Hoover met Kilgore Trout. There wasn't much to think about him, actually, even at the time of his death, except that he was young. And he didn't have any relatives in town anymore. There weren't any Bannisters in the phone book, except for The Bannister, which was a motion picture theater. Actually, there wouldn't even be a Bannister theater in there after the new phone books came out. The Bannister had been turned into a cut-rate furniture store. George Hickman Bannister's father and mother and sister, Lucy, moved away from town before either the tombstone or the field house was completed, and they couldn't be located for the dedication ceremonies. It was a very restless country, with people tearing around all the time. Every so often, somebody would stop to put up a monument. There were monuments all over the country, but it was certainly unusual for somebody from the common people to have not one but two monuments in his honor, as was the case with George Hickman Bannister. Technically, though, only the tombstone had been erected specifically for him. The field house would have gone up anyway. The money was appropriated for the field house 2 years before George Hickman Bannister was cut down in his prime. It didn't cost anything extra to name it after him. Calvary Cemetery, where George Hickman Bannister was at rest, was named in honor of a hill in Jerusalem, thousands of miles away. Many people believe that the son of the creator of the universe had been killed on that hill thousands of years ago. Dwayne Hoover didn't know whether to believe that or not. Neither did Patty Keene. And they certainly weren't worrying about it now. They had other fish to fry. Dwayne was wondering how long his attack of echolalia was likely to last, and Patty Keene had to find out if her brand newness and prettiness and outgoing personality were worth a lot to a sweet, sort of sexy, middle-aged old Pontiac dealer like Dwayne. "Anyway," she said, "it certainly is an honor to have you visit us. And those aren't the right words either, but I hope you know what I mean." "Mean," said Dwayne. "Is the food all right?" she said. "All right," said Dwayne. "It's what everybody else gets," she said. "We didn't do anything special for you." "You," said Dwayne. It didn't matter much what Dwayne said. It hadn't mattered much for years. It didn't matter much what most people in Midland City said out loud, except when they were talking about money or structures or travel or machinery or other measurable things. Every person had a clearly defined part to play, as a black person, a female high school dropout, a Pontiac dealer, a gynecologist, a gas conversion burner installer. If a person stopped living up to expectations because of bad chemicals or one thing or another, everybody went on imagining that the person was living up to expectations anyway. That was the main reason the people in Midland City were so slow to detect insanity in their associates. Their imaginations insisted that nobody changed much from day to day. Their imaginations were flywheels on the ramshackle machinery of the awful truth. When Dwayne left Patty Keene and his burger chef, when he got into his demonstrator and drove away, Patty Keene was persuaded that she could make him happy with her young body, with her bravery and cheerfulness. She wanted to cry about the lines in his face and the fact that his wife had eaten Drano and that his dog had to fight all the time because it couldn't wag its tail, about the fact that his son was a homosexual. She knew all those things about Dwayne. Everybody knew those things about Dwayne. She gazed at the tower of radio station WMCY, which Dwayne Hoover owned. It was the tallest structure in Midland City. It was 8 times as tall as the tombstone of George Hickman Bannister. It had a red light on top of it to keep airplanes away. She thought about all the new and used cars Dwayne owned. Earth scientists had just discovered something fascinating about the continent Patty Keene was standing on, incidentally. It was riding on a slab about 40 miles thick, and the slab was drifting around on molten glurp, and all the other continents had slabs of their own. When one slab crashed into one another, mountains were made. The mountains of West Virginia, for instance, were heaved up when a huge chunk of Africa crashed into North America. And the coal in the state was formed from forests, which were buried by the crash. Patty Keene hadn't heard the big news yet. Neither had Duane. Neither had Kilgore Trout. I only found out about it a day before yesterday. I was reading a magazine, and I also had the television on. A group of scientists was on television saying that the theory of floating, crashing, grinding slabs was more than a theory. They could prove it was true now, and that Japan and San Francisco, for instance, were in hideous danger, because that was where some of the most violent crashing and grinding was going on. They said, too, that ice ages would continue to occur. Mile-thick glaciers would, geologically speaking, continue to go down and up, like window blinds. Duane Hoover, incidentally, had an unusually large penis, and didn't even know it. The few women he had had anything to do with weren't sufficiently experienced to know whether he was average or not. The world average was 5 7/8 inches long and 1 1/2 inches in diameter when engorged with blood. Duane's was 7 inches long and 2 1/8 inches in diameter when engorged with blood. Duane's son, Bunny, had a penis that was exactly average. Kilgore Trout had a penis 7 inches long, but only 1 1/4 inches in diameter. Harry LeSabre, Duane's sales manager, had a penis 5 inches long and 2 1/8 inches in diameter. Cyprian Ukwende, the black physician from Nigeria, had a penis 6 7/8 inches long and 1 3/4 inches in diameter. Don Breedlove, the gas conversion unit installer who raped Patty Keene, had a penis 5 7/8 inches long and 1 7/8 inches in diameter. Patty Keene had 34-inch hips, a 26-inch waist, and a 34-inch bosom. Duane's late wife had 36-inch hips, a 28-inch waist, and a 38-inch bosom when he married her. She had 39-inch hips, a 31-inch waist, and a 38-inch bosom when she ate Drano. His mistress and secretary, Francine Pefko, had 37-inch hips, a 30-inch waist, and a 39-inch bosom. His stepmother, at the time of her death, had 34-inch hips, a 24-inch waist, and a 33-inch bosom. So Duane went from the burger chef to the construction site of the new high school. He was in no hurry to get back to his automobile agency, particularly since he had developed echolalia. Francine was perfectly capable of running the place herself. Without any advice from Duane, he had trained her well. So he kicked a little dirt down into the cellar hole. He spat down into it. He stepped into mud. It sucked off his right shoe. He dug the shoe out with his hands and he wiped it. Then he leaned against an old apple tree while he put the shoe back on. This had all been farmland when Duane was a boy. There had been an apple orchard here. Duane forgot all about Patty Keene, but she certainly hadn't forgotten him. She would get up enough nerve that night to call him on the telephone, but Duane wouldn't be home to answer. He would be in a padded cell in the county hospital by then. And Duane wandered over to admire a tremendous earth-moving machine, which had cleared the site and dug the cellar hole. The machine was idle now, caked with mud. Duane asked a white workman how many horsepower drove the machine. All the workmen were white. The workman said this, "I don't know how many horsepower, but I know what we call it." "What do you call it?" said Duane, relieved to find his echolalia was subsiding. "We call it the 100-nigger machine, said the workman. This had reference to a time when black men had done most of the heavy digging in Midland City. The largest human penis in the United States was 14 inches long and 2 1/2 inches in diameter. The largest human penis in the world was 16 7/8 inches long and 2 1/4 inches in diameter. The blue whale, a sea mammal, had a penis 96 inches long and 14 inches in diameter. One time, Duane Hoover got an advertisement through the mail for a penis extender made out of rubber. He could slip it over the end of his real penis, according to the ad, and thrill his wife or sweetheart with extra inches. They also wanted to sell him a lifelike rubber vagina for when he was lonesome. Duane went back to work at about 2 p.m, and he avoided everybody because of his echolalia. He went into his inner office, and he ransacked his desk drawers for something to read or think about. He came across the brochure which offered him the penis extender and the rubber vagina for lonesomeness. He had received it 2 months before. He still hadn't thrown it away. The brochure also offered him motion pictures such as the ones Kilgore Trout had seen in New York. There were still photographs taken from the movies, and these caused the sex excitation center in Duane's brain to send nerve impulses down to an erection center in his spine. The erection center caused the dorsal vein in his penis to tighten up, so blood could get in all right, but it couldn't get out again. It also relaxed the tiny arteries in his penis, so they filled up the spongy tissue of which Dwayne's penis was mainly composed, so that the penis got hard and stiff, like a plugged-up garden hose. So Dwayne called Francine Pefko on the telephone, even though she was only 11 feet away.
"Francine?" he said.
"Yes," she said.
Dwayne fought down his echolalia.
"I'm going to ask you to do something I have never asked you to do before. Promise me you'll say yes."
"I promise," she said.
"I want you to walk out of here with me this very moment," he said, "and come with me to the Quality Motor Court at Shepherdstown." Francine Pefko was willing to go to the Quality Motor Court with Dwayne. It was her duty to go, she thought, especially since Dwayne seemed so depressed and jangled. But she couldn't simply walk away from her desk for the afternoon, since her desk was the nerve center of Dwayne Hoover's Exit 11 Pontiac Village. "You ought to have some crazy young teenager who can rush off whenever you want her to," Francine told Dwayne.
"I don't want a crazy teenager," said Dwayne. "I want you."
"Then you're going to have to be patient," said Francine. She went back to the service department to beg Gloria Browning, the white cashier back there, to man her desk for a little while. Gloria didn't want to do it. She had had a hysterectomy only a month before at the age of 25, after a botched abortion at the Ramada Inn down in Greene County on Route 53, across from the entrance to Pioneer Village State Park. There was a mildly amazing coincidence here. The father of the destroyed fetus was Don Breedlove, the white gas conversion unit installer who had raped Patty Keene in the parking lot of the Bannister Memorial Fieldhouse. This was a man with a wife and three kids. Francine had a sign on the wall over her desk, which had been given to her as a joke at the automobile agency's Christmas party at the new Holiday Inn the year before. It spelled out the truth of her situation. It said, "Nerve Center." Gloria said she didn't want to man the nerve center. "I don't want to man anything," she said. But Gloria took over Francine's desk anyway. "I don't have nerve enough to commit suicide," she said, "so I might as well do anything anybody says in the service of mankind." Dwayne and Francine headed for Shepherdstown in separate cars so as not to call attention to their love affair. Dwayne was in a demonstrator again. Francine was in her own red GTO. GTO stood for Gran Turismo Omologato. She had a sticker on her bumper which said this: "Visit Sacred Miracle Cave." It was certainly loyal of her to put that sticker on her car. She was always doing loyal things like that, always rooting for her man, always rooting for Dwayne. And Dwayne tried to reciprocate in little ways. For instance, he had been reading articles and books on sexual intercourse recently. There was a sexual revolution going on in the country, and women were demanding that men pay more attention to women's pleasure during sexual intercourse and not just think of themselves. The key to their pleasure, they said, and scientists backed them up, was the clitoris, a tiny meat cylinder which was right above the hole in women where men were supposed to stick their much larger cylinders. Men were supposed to pay more attention to the clitoris, and Dwayne had been paying a lot more attention to Francine's, to the point where she said he was paying too much attention to it. This did not surprise him. The things he had read about the clitoris had said that this was a danger, that a man could pay too much attention to it. So driving out to the Quality Motor Court that day, Dwayne was hoping that he would pay exactly the right amount of attention to Francine's clitoris. Kilgore Trout once wrote a short novel about the importance of the clitoris in lovemaking. This was in response to a suggestion by his second wife, Darlene, that he could make a fortune with a dirty book. She told him that the hero should understand women so well that he could seduce anyone he wanted. So Trout wrote, "The Son of Jimmy Valentine." Jimmy Valentine was a famous made-up person in another writer's books, just as Kilgore Trout was a famous made-up person in my books. Jimmy Valentine, in the other writer's books, sandpapered his fingertips so they were extra sensitive. He was a safecracker. His sense of feel was so delicate that he could open any safe in the world by feeling the tumblers fall. Kilgore Trout invented a son for Jimmy Valentine named Ralston Valentine. Ralston Valentine also sandpapered his fingertips, but he wasn't a safecracker. Ralston was so good at touching women the way they wanted to be touched that tens of thousands of them became his willing slaves. They abandoned their husbands or lovers for him, in Trout's story, and Ralston Valentine became president of the United States, thanks to the votes of women. Dwayne and Francine made love in the Quality Motor Court. Then they stayed in bed for a while. It was a waterbed. Francine had a beautiful body. So did Duane.
We never made love in the afternoon before, said Francine.
I felt so tense, said Duane.
I know, said Francine. Are you better now?
Yes.
He was lying on his back. His ankles were crossed. His hands were folded behind his head. His great wang lay across his thigh like a salami. It slumbered now.
I love you so much, said Francine.
She corrected herself.
I know I promised not to say that, but that's a promise I can't help breaking all the time.
The thing was, Duane had made a pact with her that neither one of them was ever to mention love. Since Duane's wife had eaten Drano, Duane never wanted to hear about love ever again. The subject was too painful. Duane snuffled. It was customary for him to communicate by means of snuffles after sexual intercourse. The snuffles all had meanings which were bland.
That's all right. Forget it. Who could blame you? And so on.
On Judgment Day, said Francine, when they ask me what bad things I did down here, I'm going to have to tell them. Well, there was a promise I made to a man I loved, and I broke it all the time. I promised him never to say I loved him. This generous, voluptuous woman, who had only $96.11 a week in take-home pay, had lost her husband, Robert Pefko, in a war in Vietnam. He was a career officer in the Army. He had a penis 6 1/2 inches long and 1 7/8 inches in diameter. He was a graduate of West Point, a military academy which turned young men into homicidal maniacs for use in war. Francine followed Robert from West Point to parachute school at Fort Bragg and then to South Korea, where Robert managed a post exchange, which was a department store for soldiers, and then to the University of Pennsylvania, where Robert took a master's degree in anthropology at Army expense, and then back to West Point, where Robert was an assistant professor of social sciences for 3 years. After that, Francine followed Robert to Midland City, where Robert oversaw the manufacture of a new sort of booby trap. A booby trap was an easily hidden explosive device which blew up when it was accidentally twiddled in some way. One of the virtues of the new type of booby trap was that it could not be smelled by dogs. Various armies at that time were training dogs to sniff out booby traps. When Robert and Francine were in Midland City, there weren't any other military people around, so they made their first civilian friends. And Francine took a job with Duane Hoover in order to augment her husband's salary and fill her days. But then Robert was sent to Vietnam. Shortly after that, Duane's wife ate Drano, and Robert was shipped home in a plastic body bag. I pity men, said Francine, there in the quality motor court. She was sincere. I wouldn't want to be a man. They take such chances. They work so hard. They were on the second floor of the motel. Their sliding glass doors gave them a view of an iron railing and a concrete terrace outside. And then Route 103, and then the wall and the rooftops of the adult correctional institution beyond that. I don't wonder you're tired and nervous, Francine went on. If I was a man, I'd be tired and nervous too. I guess God made women so men could relax and be treated like little babies from time to time. She was more than satisfied with this arrangement. Duane snuffled. The air was rich with the smell of raspberries, which was the perfume in the disinfectant and roach killer the motel used. Francine mused about the prison, where the guards were all white and most of the prisoners were black. Is it true, she said, that nobody ever escaped from there?
It's true, said Duane.
When was the last time they used the electric chair, said Francine. She was asking about a device in the basement of the prison. The purpose of it was to kill people by jazzing them with more electricity than their bodies could stand. Duane Hoover had seen it twice, once during a tour of the prison by members of the Chamber of Commerce years ago, and then again when it was actually used on a black human being he knew. Duane tried to remember when the last execution took place at Shepherdstown. Executions had become unpopular. There were signs that they might become popular again. Duane and Francine tried to remember the most recent electrocution anywhere in the country which had stuck in their minds. They remembered the double execution of a man and a wife for treason. The couple had supposedly given secrets about how to make a hydrogen bomb to another country. They remembered the double execution of a man and a woman who were lovers. The man was good-looking and sexy, and he used to seduce ugly old women who had money, and then he and the woman he really loved would kill the women for their money. The woman he really loved was young, but she certainly wasn't pretty in the conventional sense. She weighed 240 pounds. Francine wondered out loud why a thin, good-looking young man would love a woman that heavy.
Takes all kinds, said Duane.
You know what I keep thinking, said Francine. Duane snuffled.
This would be a very good location for a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise. Duane's relaxed body contracted as though each muscle in it had been stung by a drop of lemon juice. Here was the problem. Duane wanted Francine to love him for his body and soul, not for what his money could buy. He thought Francine was hinting that he should buy her a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise, which was a scheme for selling fried chicken. The chicken was a flightless bird. The idea was to kill it and pull out all its feathers and cut off its head and feet and scoop out its internal organs and then chop it into pieces and fry the pieces and put the pieces in a waxed paper bucket with a lid on it. Francine, who had been so proud of her capacity to make Duane relax, was now ashamed to have made him tighten up again. He was as rigid as an ironing board. "Oh, my God," she said. "What's the matter now?" "If you're going to ask me for presents," said Duane, "just do me a favor, and don't hint around right after we've made love. Let's keep lovemaking and presents separate, okay?" "I don't even know what you think I asked for," said Francine. Duane mimicked her cruelly in a falsetto voice. "I don't even know what you think I asked you for," he said. He looked about as pleasant and relaxed as a coiled rattlesnake now. It was his bad chemicals, of course, which were compelling him to look like that. The creator of the universe had put a rattle on the tail of a real rattlesnake. The creator had also given it front teeth, which were hypodermic syringes filled with deadly poison. Sometimes I wonder about the creator of the universe. Another animal invented by the creator of the universe was a Mexican beetle, which could make a blank cartridge gun out of its rear end. It could detonate its own farts and knock over other bugs with shockwaves. Word of honor, I read about it in an article on strange animals in Diners Club magazine. So Francine got off the bed in order not to share it with the seeming rattlesnake. She was aghast. All she could say over and over again was, "You're my man. You're my man." This meant that she was willing to agree about anything with Duane, to do anything for him, no matter how difficult or disgusting, to think up nice things to do for him that he didn't even notice, to die for him, if necessary, and so on. She honestly tried to live that way. She couldn't imagine anything better to do. So she fell apart when Duane persisted in his nastiness. He told her that every woman was a whore, and that every whore had her price, and Francine's price was what a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise would cost, which would be well over $100,000 by the time adequate parking and exterior lighting and all that was taken into consideration, and so on. Francine replied in blubbering gibberish that she had never wanted the franchise for herself, that she had wanted it for Duane, that everything she wanted was for Duane. Some of the words came through. "I thought of all the people who come out here to visit their relatives in prison, and I realized how most of them were black, and I thought how much black people like fried chicken," she said. "So you want me to open a nigger joint?" said Duane, and so on. So Francine now had the distinction of being the second close associate of Duane's who discovered how vile he could be. "Harry LeSabre was right," said Francine. She was backed up against the cement block wall of the motel room now with her fingers spread over her mouth. Harry LeSabre, of course, was Duane's transvestite sales manager. "He said you'd change," said Francine. She made a cage of fingers around her mouth. "Oh, God, Duane," she said, "you've changed. You've changed." "Maybe it was time," said Duane. "I never felt better in my life," and so on. Harry LeSabre was at that moment crying, too. He was at home, in bed. He had a purple velvet sheet over his head. He was well-to-do. He had invested in the stock market very intelligently and luckily over the years. He had bought 100 shares of Xerox, for instance, for $8 a share. With the passage of time, his shares had become 100 times as valuable, simply lying in the total darkness and silence of a safe deposit box. There was a lot of money magic like that going on. It was almost as though some blue fairy were flitting about that part of the dying planet, waving her magic wand over certain deeds and bonds and stock certificates. Harry's wife, Grace, was stretched out on a chaise lounge at some distance from the bed. She was smoking a small cigar in a long holder made from the leg bone of a stork. A stork was a large European bird about half the size of a Bermuda urn. Children who wanted to know where babies came from were sometimes told that they were brought by storks. People who told their children such a thing felt that their children were too young to think intelligently about wide-open beavers and all that. And there were actually pictures of storks delivering babies on birth announcements and in cartoons and so on for children to see. Duane Hoover and Harry LeSabre saw pictures like that when they were very little boys.
They believed them, too.
Grace LeSabre expressed her contempt for the good opinion of Dwayne Hoover, which her husband felt he had lost.
"Fuck Dwayne Hoover," she said. "Fuck Midland City. Let's sell the goddamn Xerox stock and buy a condominium on Maui."
Maui was one of the Hawaiian islands. It was widely believed to be a paradise.
"Listen," said Grace, "we're the only white people in Midland City with any kind of sex life, as nearly as I can tell. You're not a freak. Dwayne Hoover's the freak. How many orgasms do you think he has a month?"
"I don't know," said Harry from his humid tent.
Dwayne's monthly orgasm rate, on the average, over the past 10 years, which included the last years of his marriage, was 2 1/4. Grace's guess was close. 1.5, she said. Her own monthly average over the same period was 87. Her husband's average was 36. He had been slowing up in recent years, which was one of the reasons he had for feeling panicky.
Grace now spoke loudly and scornfully about Dwayne's marriage.
"He was so scared of sex," she said. "He married a woman who had never heard of the subject, who was guaranteed to destroy herself, if she ever did hear about it," and so on. "Which she finally did," she said.
"Can the reindeer hear you?" said Harry.
"Fuck the reindeer," said Grace. Then she added,
"No, the reindeer cannot hear."
Reindeer was their code word for the black maid, who was far away in the kitchen at the time. It was their code word for black people in general. It allowed them to speak of the black problem in the city, which was a big one, without giving offense to any black person who might overhear. "The reindeer's asleep, or reading the Black Panther Digest," she said. The reindeer problem was essentially this. Nobody white had much use for black people anymore, except for the gangsters who sold the black people used cars and dope and furniture. Still, the reindeer went on reproducing. They were these useless, big black animals everywhere, and a lot of them had very bad dispositions. They were given small amounts of money every month, so they wouldn't have to steal. There was talk of giving them very cheap dope, too, to keep them listless and cheerful and uninterested in reproduction. The Midland City Police Department and the Midland County Sheriff's Department were composed mainly of white men. They had racks and racks of submachine guns and 12-gauge automatic shotguns for an open season on reindeer, which was bound to come. "Listen, I'm serious," said Grace to Harry. "This is the asshole of the universe. Let's split to a condominium on Maui and live for a change."
So they did.
Dwayne's bad chemicals, meanwhile, changed his manner towards Francine from nastiness to pitiful dependency. He apologized to her for ever thinking that she wanted a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise. He gave her full credit for unflagging selfishness. He begged her just to hold him for a while, which she did.
"I'm so confused," he said.
"We all are," she said. She cradled his head against her breasts.
"I've got to talk to somebody," said Dwayne.
"You can talk to Mommy if you want," said Francine. She meant that she was Mommy.
"Tell me what life is all about," Dwayne begged her fragrant bosom.
"Only God knows that," said Francine.
Dwayne was silent for a while, and then he told her haltingly about a trip he had made to the headquarters of the Pontiac Division of General Motors at Pontiac, Michigan, only 3 months after his wife ate Drano.
"We were given a tour of all the research facilities," he said. "The thing that impressed him most," he said, "was a series of laboratories and out-of-doors test areas where various parts of automobiles and even entire automobiles were destroyed. Pontiac scientists set upholstery on fire, threw gravel at windshields, snapped crankshafts and driveshafts, staged head-on collisions, tore gear shift levers out by the roots, ran engines at high speed with almost no lubrication, opened and closed glove compartment doors 100 times a minute for days, cooled dashboard clocks to within a few degrees of absolute zero, and so on. Everything you're not supposed to do to a car, they did to a car," Dwayne said to Francine. "And I'll never forget the sign on the front door of the building where all that torture went on." Here was the sign Dwayne described to Francine. It said, "Destructive Testing."
"I saw that sign," said Dwayne, "and I couldn't help wondering if that was what God put me on earth for, to find out how much a man could take without breaking."
"I've lost my way," said Dwayne. "I need somebody to take me by the hand and lead me out of the woods."
"You're tired," she said.
"Why wouldn't you be tired? You work so hard. I feel sorry for men, they work so hard. You want to sleep for a while?"
"I can't sleep," said Dwayne, "until I get some answers."
"You want to go to a doctor?" said Francine.
"I don't want to hear the kinds of things doctors say," said Dwayne.
"I want to talk to somebody brand new, Francine," he said, and he dug his fingers into her soft arm. "I want to hear new things from new people.
I've heard everything anybody in Midland City ever said, ever will say. It's got to be somebody new.
Like who? Said Francine.
I don't know, said Duane.
Somebody from Mars, maybe.
We could go to some other city, said Francine.
They're all like here. They're all the same, said Duane.
Francine had an idea. What about all these painters and writers and composers coming to town, she said. You never talked to anybody like that before. Maybe you should talk to one of them. They don't think like other people.
I've tried everything else, said Duane. He brightened. He nodded.
You're right. The festival could give me a brand new viewpoint on life, he said.
That's what it's for, said Francine. Use it.
I will, said Duane.
This was a bad mistake.
Kilgore Trout, hitchhiking westward, ever westward, had meanwhile become a passenger in a Ford Galaxy. The man at the controls of the Galaxy was a traveling salesman for a device which engulfed the rear ends of trucks at loading docks. It was a telescoping tunnel of rubberized canvas. The idea of the gadget was to allow people in a building to load or unload trucks without losing cold air in the summertime or hot air in the wintertime to the out-of-doors. The man in control of the Galaxy also sold large spools for wire and cable and rope. He also sold fire extinguishers. He was a manufacturer's representative, he explained. He was his own boss, in that he represented products whose manufacturers couldn't afford salesmen of their own. I make my own hours, and I pick the products I sell. The products don't sell me, he said. His name was Andy Lieber. He was 32. He was white. He was a good deal overweight, like so many people in the country. He was obviously a happy man. He drove like a maniac. The Galaxy was going 92 miles an hour now. I'm one of the few remaining free men in America, he said. He had a penis 1 inch in diameter and 7.5 inches long. During the past year, he had averaged 22 orgasms per month. This was far above the national average. His income and the value of his life insurance policies at maturity were also far above average. Trout wrote a novel one time which he called How You Doin', and it was about national averages for this and that. An advertising agency on another planet had a successful campaign for the local equivalent of Earthling peanut butter. The eye-catching part of each ad was the statement of some sort of average, the average number of children, the average size of the male sex organ on that particular planet, which was 2 inches long, with an inside diameter of 3 inches, and an outside diameter of 4.25 inches, and so on. The ads invited the readers to discover whether they were superior or inferior to the majority, in this respect, or that one, whatever the respect was for that particular ad. The ad went on to say that superior and inferior people alike ate such and such brand of peanut butter, except it wasn't really peanut butter on that planet, it was Shaz butter, and so on. 16. And the peanut butter eaters on Earth were preparing to conquer the Shaz butter eaters on the planet in the book by Kilgore Trout. By this time, the Earthlings hadn't just demolished West Virginia and Southeast Asia. They had demolished everything, so they were ready to go pioneering again. They studied the Shaz butter eaters by means of electronic snooping and determined that they were too numerous and proud and resourceful ever to allow themselves to be pioneered. So the Earthlings infiltrated the ad agency, which had the Shaz butter account, and they buggered the statistics in the ads. They made the average for everything so high that everybody on the planet felt inferior to the majority in every respect. And then the Earthling armored spaceships came in and discovered the planet. Only token resistance was offered here and there because the natives felt so below average. And then the pioneering began. Trout asked the happy manufacturer's representative what it felt like to drive a Galaxy, which was the name of the car. The driver didn't hear him, and Trout let it go. It was a dumb play on words, so that Trout was asking simultaneously what it was like to drive a car and what it was like to steer something like the Milky Way, which was 100,000 light-years in diameter and 10,000 light-years thick. It revolved once every 200 million years. It contained about 100 billion stars. And then Trout saw that a simple fire extinguisher in the Galaxy had this brand name, Excelsior. As far as Trout knew, this word meant higher, in a dead language. It was also a thing a fictitious mountain climber in a famous poem kept yelling as he disappeared into a blizzard up above. And it was also the trade name for wood shavings, which were used to protect fragile objects inside packages. Why would anybody name a fire extinguisher Excelsior? Trout asked the driver. The driver shrugged. Somebody must have liked the sound of it, he said. Trout looked out at the countryside, which was smeared by high velocity. He saw this sign. It said, Visit Sacred Miracle Cave, 162 miles. So he was getting really close to Duane Hoover.
And as though the creator of the universe or some other supernatural power were preparing him for the meeting, Trout felt the urge to thumb through his own book, Now It Can Be Told. It was the book which would soon turn Duane into a homicidal maniac. The premise of the book was this. Life was an experiment by the creator of the universe, who wanted to test a new sort of creature he was thinking of introducing into the universe. It was a creature